The House moves closer to impeachment, but any closer to the removal of the commander-in-chief? A breakdown of the next steps in the process today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown in the Texas Standard Newsroom. As members of the House prepare to vote on the removal of a president, they also hand him a political victory on trade, one that will have a real impact on the Lone Star State. Plus, the eyes of Texas might be upon you more than you think. A closer look at the state's network of surveillance centers. And a surprising shift in the incarceration of minorities. All those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 11th day of December 2019. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Does anyone out there in radio or podcast land remember the name Ronnie Jackson? That ring a bell, anyone? Apparently, the folks at Vanity Fair remember the name. You may recall that the former Navy officer and one-time White House physician was, once upon a time, on an apparent fast track to become the next head of the Department of Veterans Affairs, a $200 billion, 360,000-person federal agency, a nomination that went off the rails after allegations of drinking on the job, including an incident involving the crash of a Secret Service vehicle and dispensing pills to White House staffers with such regularity that he picked up the nickname Candyman. Fake news, said the president, Mr. Trump standing by his nominee, but Jackson withdrew his name from consideration. That was back in April of 2018. Well, now it appears Jackson is ready to make a comeback. After Monday night's filing deadline for Texas political races, Vanity Fair spotted Jackson's completed paperwork to run for Congress in his home state of you-know-where, hoping to replace Mack Thornberry in Texas 13. Thornberry is one of several Texas Republican congressfolk who've announced their retirement. There are 12 other Republicans who'll be jousting with Jackson in the primary, though he's the one most likely to get a White House endorsement. The further implied assumption, of course, is that such an endorsement wouldn't be a liability because, as you probably know by now, we are just a few steps away from an apparent impeachment. Here to help us understand what happens next on that front, Jeffrey A. Engel. He is founding director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University, SMU. Professor Engel, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, good to talk to you again.
Good to talk with you, sir. So let's back up for just a moment because I think people hear the word impeachment repeatedly. They see things going on television, and it's easy to sort of lose the plot here. Now that the articles of impeachment have apparently been drawn up, what's the next shoe to drop?
Well, the first thing we need to remember, of course, is that impeachment does not mean removal from office. In our society, we tend to conflate those two terms.
Right.
The articles of impeachment that are now being drawn up by the Judiciary Committee will have to be voted out of committee. The Democrats have a majority, so it's expected that they are going to get that passed, probably, honestly, along straight bipartisan lines. Then it goes to the full House next week for debate. Now, when I say debate, please don't think that people are going to be talking to each other. What that really means is that every congressperson is going to get up and give their own unique soliloquy on what they think about the impeachment experience, which means it's going to take a couple of days. Then, once that passes the House, presuming that it does, it goes to the Senate. And the Senate, there is a trial to determine the president's guilt or innocence based upon those articles. And that trial, it seems, is going to be set for early January.
I want to understand what happens with the House Judiciary Committee. Do they indeed debate these two impeachment articles that were drafted, the abuse of power and obstruction of Congress? I mean, is there an actual – how do those hearings play out?
Well, hopefully the Judiciary Committee is where people from both sides of the aisle will come together and try to determine whether or not they have articles of impeachment that they can all agree upon and vote upon. Now, what we're seeing is not so much a debate in all these committees and likely in the House floor to come up, but rather just a series of counterfactuals, counter questions, counter arguments. The Democrats appear to be really moving forward with their evidence-based case for impeaching the president. And what's fascinating is that Republicans on the committee are essentially arguing a different set of evidence and arguing a different set of facts. And so we're not seeing, as we saw in the Nixon case, and even to some extent as we saw in the Clinton case, people moving across the aisle, reviewing the evidence and coming to their own conclusion. What we're seeing in this case is strictly a partisan vote, which I think speaks ill of both parties, to be honest, because we all want our congresspeople to actually be able to have the sense of duty to review the evidence rather than just do what their leaders tell them.
You know, I hear you talking about evidence, and there's been a lot of conversation about whether or not there will be an actual trial in the Senate. These are legal terms. Isn't impeachment a fundamentally political process?
It is. And I have to say, I've been getting a lot of trouble with my lawyer friends and law school professor friends because I keep making that point that we can talk about evidence. We can talk about what standard of evidence, whether it needs to rise to the level of a criminal case, whether it needs to rise to the level of what would work in a federal statute violation. But what we really need to remember is that ultimately the Senate is allowed to decide whether the president stays or goes, period. I mean, based on whatever they want.
If the senator quits Trump, what happens?
A lot of tweets, I imagine, will occur from both sides. And I think we should all expect that that's going to happen. That seems to be the most likely outcome at this point. And then I think, you know, what this does is really just kick us back into high gear with the political focus being on the Democratic primary. I mean, President Trump obviously is going to claim not only victory, but vindication. He's going to claim that the trial proves that he's innocent and that this was a railroaded attempt to simply have a coup against his government. And the Democratic candidates will essentially be vying to see who is going to continue that fight all the way up until November.
Jeffrey A. Engel is founding director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU. Professor, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us on the Texas Standard.
Good to talk to you.
Well, something House Democrats and the president seem to be in agreement on is a revised trade deal between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. You may have heard it called the USMCA. Not quite as snappy as that proper acronym NAFTA, but it stands for U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, so there you have it. Shortly after announcing their articles of impeachment against President Trump yesterday, House Democrats announced they'd reached a deal with the president regarding this USMCA. And here to help us break down the specifics of what both sides regard as a new and improved trade deal and its effect on us is Raymond Robertson, director of the Mussbacher Institute for Trade Economics and Public Policy at Texas A&M University. Professor Robertson, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
Some key takeaways from this new deal. Someone asks you at a cocktail party, what's new about this thing? What do you tell them?
Well, it represents the biggest win for labor that we've seen in any trade agreement. It actually required a number of changes in Mexico's labor law that went into effect earlier this year that would protect union organizers and people trying to organize and collective bargain. There's a number of other changes, of course, in the automobile industry and in pharmaceuticals, but those seem to be taking us a back seat.
A revamp of a trade deal was a big part of President Trump's promise during his 2016 campaign. And just on the surface, of course, a lot of commentators were reflecting on the fact that it appeared that the U.S. House of Representatives handed Trump a kind of a political victory card that he can use in the upcoming election cycle. You think that's true?
Yeah, I definitely think that's true. One of the good things I think about this agreement is not so much in the change and the macroeconomic effects that the agreement will have, but just that it represents bipartisanship. It represents an actual collaboration across the parties, which is something we haven't seen very much in Congress.
Still need to be voted on in the House and Senate, of course, and Mexico and Canada, I presume, need to sign off as well, although something tells me that Mexico has already said okay to this deal. What am I getting confused about?
Yeah, Mexico actually already had ratified the agreement, and they were waiting for the United States and Canada to ratify. Canada said that they were not going to ratify until the United States ratified, and the United States wasn't going to ratify until Congress was satisfied that there was some changes in enforcement and in the labor provisions. Now that those seem to have been completed, we expect the United States to ratify, and then we would expect Canada to follow suit.
Do you see any parts of this deal that will be particularly advantageous for those of us here in Texas, as we're a gateway, certainly, to Mexico?
Yeah, this agreement is very important for Texas because Texas is very closely integrated into the Mexican economy. What we've seen over the last several years is that because we didn't have the agreement and it wasn't ratified, there was a lot of uncertainty within Mexico. uncertainty within Mexico can be very dangerous because we rely on Mexico for parts, for our manufacturing. We also have migration issues as well, because there's more undocumented migration that comes in when the Mexican economy falters. And without this agreement, there's a big risk of that.
Think about how long it took to get NAFTA together. What do you make of how quickly this one went through?
I think the situation is very, very different now than it was. First of all, the modifications to this agreement relative to NAFTA are very small. They're not very large. And if you looked at the tariff schedules, the tariff changes that NAFTA was implying were much larger than the ones implied by the USMCA. And thirdly, the structure of production has changed dramatically. Texas and Mexico are now very closely integrated, even to the point where my own research shows that the U.S. and Mexican workers are complements in production, which means they're producing parts of the same final goods. They're actually working now as a team collaboratively through these global value chains, rather than back in the early 90s where they were actually competing for jobs.
You see a downside to this deal?
Well, it doesn't open up markets as much as NAFTA. It's actually more managed trade. And so we'd like to see more free trade than managed trade. That's one of the things. One of my big concerns is that some of the requirements in the automobile industry that raise domestic content and the wage provisions that require a certain amount, 30%, of the production to be made by workers making more than $16 an hour, actually are going to raise costs in North America. If you think of North America as a single unit, we're competing with Asia and Europe and eventually Africa. And this agreement actually makes it a little bit harder for us to compete with those other regions.
Raymond Robertson is director of the Mosbacher Institute for Trade, Economics, and Public Policy, Texas A&M University. Professor Robertson, thanks again.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Let's check in on social media across the Lone Star State. Here's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David. The topic just at hand, generating talk on social media. House Democrats' declaration that they've reached a deal with the White House over the USMCA, that new trade deal replacing NAFTA. Despite criticism from some on the left that giving the White House a political win undermines the case for impeachment, most folks on our Facebook page support the development. Mark Terrell calls the deal a win for labor and the Democrats. And Carol Cutter Gonzalez says, I think Dems are showing Americans that they can govern and close deals. Trump and the GOP just want the photo op, but after the cameras are done flashing, it's actually the Dems that are working hard for the people. They did the hard work to actually negotiate and finalize this deal. But, Carol adds, will people notice? Can hard work gain more attention than obnoxious rallies and Twitter tantrums? I guess we won't know that until November 2020. I suppose we won't, will we, Carol? Just one story we're watching. Be back with more reactions from social media later in the show.
I bet there are a lot of hunches out there about whether Carol's right or wrong. We'd love to hear from you, Texas. Tweet us, won't you, at Texas Standard. You know, you don't have to use Twitter. You can use other social media formats, too. Our social media editor is well-versed in all of them. He'll be back in 35 or so with more of your comments.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a statewide network of physicians treating more than 50,000 new cancer patients each year with technology and cancer-fighting care options. More at TexasOncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at BecomeACASA.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
Hey, it's a Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Many U.S. asylum seekers continue to wait in Mexico for the immigration court cases to unfold on the other side of the border. This is part of the Trump administration's Remain in Mexico policy, don't you know? But the logistics of it aren't exactly working for the Mexican government. It's tried for months to clear a tent encampment of 1,500 U.S. asylum seekers in Matamoros and move them to a new campsite nearby. As Texas Public Radio's Ronaldo Leaños Jr. tells us, not everyone is ready to move.
Last month, a Mexican official with the Federal Child Welfare Agency came to the camp and threatened to separate children from their families if they didn't move to a new government-run shelter. They told parents their children would be sent back to their home countries. This weekend, dozens of Mexican immigration officials, federal police, and National Guard were scattered throughout the encampment. Enrique Maciel, a regional delegate for Tamaulipas Institute for Migrants, spoke to a group of asylum seekers about a new government structure he wants them to move to by the Rio Grande.
No me puedes decir tú ni nadie.
You or anyone else can't tell me it's going to be more comfortable to be outside than under a tall tent where you're going to have lots of benefits. The groups from the Rio Grande Valley, the ones that come to help, will continue to help in the tent.
Mexican authorities want the asylum seekers to move there instead of being in a plaza near the international bridge. But some migrants are hesitant to cooperate with Mexican officials.
No es una obligación. Es recomendable.
It's not an obligation. It's recommended. It's healthy for the benefit of your families to go to a place more hygienic.
Melissa is from Honduras.
Ellos llegaron hace una hora diciéndonos que nos movamos de forma voluntaria.
They got here about an hour ago, saying it would be voluntary, but if we didn't move voluntarily, then they would come to move us. They told us yesterday that they wouldn't bring so much law enforcement. But if you look around, it's like we were in Iraq and a bombardment is about to begin.
Melissa says she's not going to move from the area, but others at a different part of the encampment have started moving their tents. Melissa says it's because those migrants are new and have recently arrived.
They're trying to scare and pressure them. But we who've been here for months, trust me, the pressure, the fear, I don't suffer from it anymore.
Two teenage boys are gathering their belongings. Now they're picking up their tent. On top of the tent is a black trash bag that helps provide further protection from the elements. The boys make their way up some steps that go down to an area where the new government tent structure is. I asked one of the boys why he's moving his tent today.
Porque lo están corriendo.
He tells me it's because they're being kicked out from where they were at. One man who didn't want his name used because he fears speaking out will put him in danger says he was also told if they didn't move, they would be forced to.
Para evitar esa clase de problemas,
to avoid any types of problems, we decided to come.
A woman who also didn't want her name being used is now neighbors with the man under the government tent. She says she was told the same thing and that this doesn't feel optional.
Andan federales.
There are federal police. There's all types of police. It's not that you want, it's that you have to move. If you look up, immigration, they all have cameras, and we feel so intimidated.
All asylum seekers I spoke with said officials told them at first the move is optional, but if they choose not to go, then they would be forced to. I'm Reynaldo Leanios Jr. in Matamoros.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. More money is about to be flowing into Texas's surveillance centers across the state. What, you didn't know about these surveillance centers Texas maintains? If not, that's kind of by design. The Texas Department of Public Safety helps to oversee these intelligence gathering centers, and they don't talk much about what they do, all of which got the attention of Dave Lieber, a watchdog columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Dave, thanks for your time.
Thank you, sir.
Tell us a little bit about how these centers got started and what it is that they do exactly. I mean, the mind's eye imagines a room full of big TV screens and, you know, little dots zooming in on each other and that kind of thing, like out of the movies.
Well, I think that's what they're like. They do have a lot of screens from the pictures that I've seen. I've never been inside of one. But also what they have is a lot of access to databases. Some of them are public databases that you and I can access, but some of them also are law enforcement databases, you know, federal level stuff, FBI stuff. And they call them fusion centers because they fuse local, state, and federal law enforcement all together inside a joint operation.
Now, I've seen these sorts of centers that, you know, sort of activated, or similar centers activated at times of emergency. I was thinking about Hurricane Harvey, for example. Are these centers always in operation or what?
Yeah, they're always in operation. They keep running all the time. They're basically substations of police departments.
And so what are they doing on a regular basis as, you know, in terms of surveillance?
Well, what we know is, for example, let's say you go to the Alamo and you stand outside and you start taking a lot of pictures and you look a little bit suspicious. The trap wire system, which is a camera system, will send video or photos of you taking pictures back to one of the fusion centers. They could use facial recognition software, for example, to find out who you are and if you're there just taking pictures as a tourist or if you're taking pictures because you have some kind of nefarious act that you want to commit to the Alamo. So they're watching landmarks across Texas, important places like the governor's mansions and places like that with video.
But they're also doing database searches for police departments who are looking for criminals or who are looking for possible terrorists or troublemakers.
How long has the state been doing this?
I think the first one opened up in Austin about 2007. They started after 9/11. The idea was that police departments didn't coordinate properly.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we can create these fusion centers, we can share information and we can prevent terrorist acts.
And so why are they getting more resources right now?
Well, my theory is that in lieu of like gun control legislation to stop mass shooters, which is something that probably won't happen in Texas, they can beef up the surveillance side instead. And hopefully they want to be able to realize who is up to some kind of a terrorist act before they do it because they post something on social media.
But if we don't know more about how these centers operate, what sort of technology they're using, you mentioned facial recognition, for example, and I think that may surprise a lot of Texans that the state is using it against its own citizens, perhaps. Where's the accountability when it comes to issues of privacy that Texans value deeply?
Well, it would have to come through the Texas legislature, which doesn't really seem to really be that concerned about protecting our privacy. They'd be the ones that would be monitoring DPS. Really, not a lot has happened in the legislature regarding surveillance and privacy. So that's why I wanted to write this story, because I wanted to remind everybody that, you know, this is going on. Governor Abbott brought it out when he issued an executive order after one of the mass shootings, mm-hmm. saying we want to beef up the staff for these fusion centers, and we also want to add a lot more money to them, too, so they can do more.
Dave, where are these so-called fusion centers, and what did you find there?
Well, they're actually all over the state, David. The research editor at the Morning News, Erin Sood, she helped me figure out where they are. The main one is in Austin at the DPS headquarters, and then there's one in Dallas, Fort Worth, McKinney, El Paso, Houston, and San Antonio.
Dave Lieber is watchdog columnist for the Dallas Morning News. We'll link to his story at texasstandard.org. Dave, thanks again for your time.
Thank you, sir.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Former Texas Governor Rick Perry says evidence will emerge to prove Ukraine interfered with in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Perry, who stepped down as Energy Secretary this month, is one of the latest Republicans to advance the debunked conspiracy theory. He told Fox News Channel this morning about his work in the country before Volodymyr Zelensky was elected president there.
I got the clear indication in just casual conversations with the country's leadership at that particular point in time, well before Zelensky, that there was some interest in our election, and it wasn't necessarily in President Trump's favor.
U.S. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, among other GOP lawmakers, have made similar claims that Ukraine, alongside Russia, worked to manipulate the 2016 election. The Houston Police Department and the Houston Police Officers Union is urging officers to wear additional body armor after Sergeant Christopher Brewster was fatally shot this past weekend. The 32-year-old was wearing a bulletproof vest at the time. Joe Gamaldi is the union's president.
Now, they're still trying to determine if the suspect was using an armor-piercing round, but in the meantime, we wanted our officers to be safe, so we encouraged them to put on their heavy vests, which are actually rifle-resistant vests, to make sure that they had that extra layer of protection in the off chance that this is a larger issue and a systemic issue with the vest.
A visitation will be held for Sergeant Brewster this evening, followed by funeral services tomorrow. Both are open to the public. MJ Hegger supports ending open carry within Texas, which became state law in 2016. The retired Air Force officer is one of 11 Democrats in their party's primary for the U.S. Senate in Texas. She told Texas Tribune CEO Evan Smith this morning that open carry actually threatens Second Amendment rights and responsible gun ownership.
because it is an assault on bystanders. Because I was at Pecan Street Festival and some guy thought he needed to walk around with a bullhorn and a backpack full of, you know, signs sticking out of it, yelling, and he's carrying an automatic rifle. I told my kids, I don't care that you have half a dragon painted on your face. Let's go. We're out of here. And that's how a lot of people felt.
Other Democrats vying to unseat Republican U.S. Senator John Cornyn include State Senator Royce West of Dallas and former Houston Congressman Chris Bell. Private spaceflight company Blue Origin is preparing to launch its new Shepard rocket from West Texas today once heavy fog clears. The company canceled yesterday's launch from Van Horn due to weather conditions. Blue Origin said on Twitter they're aiming for liftoff in roughly 30 minutes. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The United States holds the dubious distinction of having the highest incarceration rate in the world, 655 per 100,000 people. Of our 50 states, Texas is near the top at number 7, and Texas, like the country overall, sees disparate rates of incarceration along racial lines, with Black and Hispanic inmates overrepresented in correctional facilities. But a new study from the think tank Council on Criminal Justice shows that racial disparities in incarceration nationwide are declining. So is the gap that persisted throughout most of the nation's history finally closing? Joining us now, Thaddeus Johnson. He's PhD candidate in criminal justice and criminology at Georgia State University and co-author of this report. Professor Johnson, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So what were some of the key findings of this report?
Well, some of the key findings were, and first I will say they were very encouraging numbers, but it's a little bit difficult to celebrate something that shouldn't exist in the first place. And disparity still is this. But some of the more intriguing findings really dealt with the drug crime and the imprisonment rates for drug crimes. For instance, we saw the numbers drop, I mean, drastically. And even more telling was we saw the disparity and decline to be more precipitous for women as opposed to men. And so we thought that was pretty interesting. Other interesting findings were that across the board, we saw the populations in prisons, parole, probation. We saw the disparities decline all across the board. But getting back to the drug crimes, what was very interesting is that we saw that the arrest rates, the prison admission rates, and the imprisonment rates for Blacks decreased dramatically. However, we saw that the expected time served was much higher than that of whites.
I want to make sure that we understand something, because when we talk about closing the gap, there are a couple of ways of doing that. On the one hand, you could have fewer people of color actually being arrested, or perhaps you could have more white people, for instance, being arrested. I mean, so what exactly is going on here?
So what we're seeing is a drastic drop in the number of African Americans, particularly. We saw drops with the Hispanic population as well, but they were much more dramatic with the Black population. And what we saw was that the number of arrest rates declined so much, also the admission rates. And we believe that the possible growth in the mean expected stay or prison stays has something to do with possibly criminal histories.
I'm curious about whether or not this is actually happening sort of at all levels of government. You have the federal system, of course. You also have the state and local systems. Where do you see these changes happening at a greatest level?
Now, that's the thing. We also saw declines at the federal level. They had the same pattern and trend, but wasn't so drastic. And for what we can tell, this is really happening in imprisonment, but we need a little bit more research so we can dig down at the local level and see what's really going on in the jails, see what's really going on in the police departments, see what policy changes are being made at the local level. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit early to answer that question, but if I can have an educated speculation, we would say that it's probably something going on at the localized level that's working its way up through the state prisons that may be the process that we see.
So what's happening? A change in attitude, a change in terms of how laws are being written or rewritten? Are we seeing something happen in terms of a turnover in judges? What seems to be happening?
Well, one, this is a little bit beyond the scope of the data, but we kind of connected some dots, and we're actually going to delve off into some more research on this topic. But it could possibly be with the drug crimes. It's really a drug story, a crime story that we see.
Mm.
And with that being the case, it could be a possible fact that the emphasis on what we consider to be drugs associated with black communities, like marijuana and crack cocaine, and more of an emphasis on enforcing those drugs like opioids, methamphetamines, things associated with rule in both white areas and white citizens.
Mm-hmm.
So that could possibly be a thing. I mean, you start seeing decline starting in 2000. I know in 1996, toward the tail end of the war on what we consider black drugs, we started to see acts that started focusing on opioids, acts that started focusing on methamphetamine and things. And so it's obvious that the focus is now on those drugs that's traditionally associated with white citizens in rural areas. So,
What about the gender factor, though? I mean, if you were women being arrested these days?
Now, that is very intriguing and very interesting, and that's the actual study that we're about to partake on. We're really are not sure what's going on with that. We do know, if we want to talk about drugs, we do know that there has been an increase in the number of white women as far as overdose rates, as far as drug usage rates.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen that. And again, while we say even though these findings are encouraging, we urge people to take caution when interpreting these things, because there's so much more work needs to be done.
Thaddeus Johnson is among those who digging deep on many of these questions. He's PhD candidate in criminal justice and criminology at Georgia State University and co-author of a new report. We'll link to a summary over at texasstandard.org. Thaddeus, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
No, thank you for having me. I really appreciate you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
You're tuned to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Have you heard the name William Gorgas ring a bell? You may have if you spend any time at Texas Southmost College in Brownsville. There's a big building there that's named after Gorgas, once a famous Army physician. Back in the 1880s, the building that now bears his name was the hospital Gorgas ran. Texas Standard commentator W.F. Strong says what Gorgas learned there would eventually change the world.
Gorgas was just 27 years old when he arrived at Fort Brown. There was a full-blown yellow fever epidemic raging at the time. Yellow fever was not only deadly, it was quick. You could feel fine on Wednesday morning, have symptoms kick in that afternoon, and be dead by Saturday. Gorgas fought yellow fever head-on. He didn't yet know that mosquitoes spread it, but he did know that good sanitation and quarantining patients was useful. He launched public health measures that helped cut short the epidemic. Perhaps the best thing that happened to him during this time, and it will seem a strange thing to say, is that he came down with yellow fever himself, but it gave him lifelong immunity. He vowed to make fighting the disease his life's work. His next significant posting in his war on yellow fever was to Cuba. It was there that the research of the Cuban doctor Carlos Finlay had laid out a convincing case for mosquitoes being responsible for transmitting the illness. Walter Reed, a name you likely recognize, tested Finlay's theories and proved without a doubt that mosquitoes were responsible. Then Gorgas put that knowledge to practical use with fumigation, screening, and outlawing of open cisterns and standing water. Astoundingly, those efforts virtually wiped out yellow fever in Havana in a couple of years. Then Dr. Gorgas made his leap onto the world stage. You will remember that the French had tried to dig the Panama Canal but failed miserably because they lost thousands of workers to yellow fever. Disease drove them out and silenced the steam shovels. The Americans, in a cannot-fail bid to do what the French could not, resumed the dig. But in the first years, yellow fever and malaria threatened to drive the Americans out too. Some said it would have taken 50 years and 80,000 lives to finish the canal under those conditions. Gorgas was brought in to solve the problem, but the political leaders in charge, they didn't want to hear anything about this mosquito theory. They told him to keep that crazy theory to himself because Everyone knew that those tropical illnesses came from miasma, bad air. Gorgas wanted to take what he had learned in Brownsville in Cuba and put it to work on a grand scale in Panama. He applied for $1 million to protect Panama. The U.S. gave him $50,000. But with such poor funding, hundreds of workers were dying each month, and the Americans risked being embarrassed by failure just like the French. Teddy Roosevelt himself intervened and more or less said, "Give Gorgas what he wants." So it was then that Gorgas screened all the houses, buildings, and particularly the hospitals in the canal. Gorgas also had an army of fumigators at work across the isthmus every day. Within 2 years, yellow fever had been completely eradicated from Panama. Gorgas was considered the medical hero of the canal because without his work, the engineers and diggers and construction workers could never have done theirs. After Panama, Gorgas eventually became Surgeon General of the U.S. Army and was knighted by the King of England for his work in tropical diseases. Here at Texas Southmost College, funded from this very building, are many fine programs in nursing and health professions active today. I think Gorgas would be pleased. I'm W.F. Strong. These are stories from Texas. Some of them are true.
W.F. Strong is a Fulbright Scholar and Professor of Culture and Communication, University of Texas, RGV. You can check out his stories from Texas on iTunes or wherever fine podcasts are served. Well, the University of North Texas, UNT, says it has opened the state's first college cafeteria free of the Big Eight, those ingredients blamed for most food allergies. From KERA North Texas, Bill Zeeble made a trip to Denton to get the scoop.
Chef Rudy Vasquez is busy deep frying one of today's lunch specials, chicken fingers. Only there's no wheat on the flour-dredged meat. The breading is gluten-free because some people are allergic to it or have celiac disease.
And so we experimented with a number of different flour blends. Some of them had too much of one particular flour, such as rice or tapioca or potato starch, and some didn't have enough. So we had to find the right balance.
Vasquez embraced the challenge to keep the flavor, but change the flour. UNT's Executive Director of Dining Services, Peter Balabuck, says delivering big taste is a big deal.
Ultimately, we're culinarians. We're chefs. So the idea is taking food, making it outstanding, minus these ingredients.
These ingredients are milk, eggs, peanuts, wheat, soy, tree nuts, fish, and shellfish. The nonprofit FAIR, which stands for Food Allergy Research and Education, says 32 million Americans have food allergies or intolerances. Symptoms can range from mild itching to closing the air passage in the throat. In that rare case, a food allergy can kill. At first, Kitchen West manager Mike Falk feared everything made here would turn bland. But he says the meals have not become hospital food.
And some things, they may taste a little different. The cheese, because it's plant-based. When we make our gravies, you want to have rice milk or plant-based cream. And that product is going to have a little off taste to it that they're not familiar with. But it's still got a great flavor profile. Nothing leaves the kitchen until every cook in here has tasted the food. If it's not perfect, it don't go out.
Connor Jones likes it.
It's awesome. It's delicious.
He's a 23-year-old UNT senior who learned when he was little that he couldn't tolerate gluten or dairy. So for him, Kitchen West goes down easy.
I can come here and just know that anything in here is good for me to have. We have incredible chefs here, you know.
Balabuck says delivering top taste without the top eight allergens has taken some work.
We've changed over all of the cookware. We did a deep sanitizing of the kitchen. We brought in all new plates. Getting the ingredients in that we can verify on the ingredient list. If it says something that's manufactured in a facility that has tree nuts, we're not getting it.
UNT's registered dietitian, Samantha Kreshak, says establishing and maintaining high allergen-free standards wasn't just championed by staff or students.
I think as parents, you worry a lot sending your kid off to college for the first time, and especially with a kid with a food allergy. So it doesn't provide a safe place just for the student, but it provides comfort to the parent.
Paul Antico is one of those parents. Three of his seven kids have food allergies. He lives in New England and has spent years seeking restaurants safe for the whole family. About a decade ago, he launched the Allergy Eats webpage to help other parents. It lists restaurant allergy policies and menus. Antico's never seen something quite like what UNT's created.
This one is really unique. I have not seen a college that has a dining hall that's entirely free of top eight. And I don't know how many stations they have there, but assuming they have multiple stations, that's really revolutionary because it's also offering kids a lot of choice, which is great.
UNT hopes all of its students who need this cafeteria will choose it and think it's great too. What the chefs would love is for students to eat here without needing to, then come back, never realizing it's allergen-free. That would be the cherry on top. I'm Bill Zeeble for the Texas Standard.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, launching Lead On, a campaign for TCU, with a $1 billion goal to support people and programs striving to make a positive impact on the world. TCU, Lead On.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Texas Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller shared a photo on his Facebook page of U.S. National Guard Sergeant Leanne Hester celebrating her achievements. Or did he? Joining us to talk about what appears to be a mystery is the head of PolitiFact Texas, Madeline Meckelberg, based at the Austin American-Statesman. Good to see you, ma'am.
Good to see you, too.
I'm trying to get to the mysterious aspect of this because on the face of it, it doesn't sound like there's much of a mystery here. You know, right? I mean, he's the Texas Ag Commissioner sharing right. the picture of someone who is doing service as a National Guardsman, and right?
I mean, that's right. And the Facebook post included, it was copy and pasted directly from an article about this sergeant detailing her actions in combat. She won the Silver Star Medal in 2005, and she was the first woman to do so since World War II.
Wow.
So she's a big deal. There's a lot of stuff that's been written about her, and yeah, he shared this post on his Facebook page.
So why are you picking on Sid here?
So when you first look at the image, you're right. There's nothing pops out as being inaccurate. The photo includes her name written across the top, Leanne Hester, and then it describes her actions. It says she was ambushed in Salman Pak, Iraq. She killed three enemy combatants in close quarter battle, and she was awarded a Silver Star. And that's all accurate.
That's all true.
That's right. That is a representation of her actions.
So we're all done.
But the issue here is actually the image itself.
What do you mean the issue is the image itself?
It appears to be of a woman other than the Leanne Hester, who's the subject of the article and the post that he shared.
Oh.
So when you look at the picture, it's of a white woman. She's wearing a military uniform. She has blue eyes, dark brown hair, and she's looking right at the camera posing for this photograph. She has mud on the right side of her face and mud on the uniform, and it's covering up the name tag on the uniform, so she's not identified.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I said, Hester is a celebrated soldier. She won this significant award, and multiple news outlets profiled her.
Hmm.
There was an action figure modeled after her.
Wow.
There's a wax figure in her likeness on display at the U.S. Army Women's Museum.
Mm-hmm.
So a quick Google search of her name pulls up dozens and dozens of images of Hester. She's a blonde woman. Her eyes are different color than the woman in the photograph. It's clearly a different person when you look at her photo versus that photo.
Well, no, how did you just happen to know what Sergeant Hester looked like and this tipped you off or what?
So this post was flagged through PolitiFact's partnership with Facebook, where they flagged posts that are potentially misleading or contain inaccurate information.
Right.
The text was accurate, so the only other option here was the image. So I plopped it into a Google reverse image search, and it pulled up a GQ series about women soldiers that published in 2013, and it included this image. And the cutline for the image said that it was Lieutenant Tina Turner, not Sergeant Leanne Hester.
Or the singer Tina Turner.
Right.
Right. So this was Lieutenant Tina Turner, not Sergeant Hester.
That's right. And to be fair, Hester was mentioned in this article that talked about female military achievements.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a photo of her in the piece, but this image was clearly labeled as Turner.
How did the Agriculture Commissioner, Sid Miller, explain the misappropriation of this image?
I reached out to his office to ask just that, and they said that they received this image from several different veterans who follow his page on Facebook, mm-hmm. and they asked him to repost it. His spokesman actually told me they wouldn't have any way to know that the image was not Hester, but obviously that is inaccurate. I found it via a quick Google image search, Hester and the woman who's actually in the photo.
I wonder how many people, though, would actually go to the trouble of doing a reverse image search if someone sent in a picture and you're trying to sort of celebrate a soldier hero.
That's exactly the problem here. There was no verification that went into posting this photo. People will take it at face value, so that's where I come in.
All right. So I I think I know how this is going to wind up, but can you go ahead and make a call at this juncture?
Yeah, we rated this image false.
False is the call about the image that appears on Texas Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller's Facebook page, purporting to be that of National Guard Sergeant Lee Ann Hester. It is not. It is of Lieutenant Tina Turner. Is that right? Okay. Madeline Meckelberg is head of PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, good to see you again, and we will see you again next week.
Can't wait.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Joining us once again in the studio, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. So what are you hearing from Texans on this Wednesday, Wells?
Hi, David. An interesting article from Politico about Democratic presidential contender Joe Biden and sparking a lot of conversation there. Interesting here, the news site reporting that Biden himself is telling aides and assistants that he would serve only a single term. Politico quotes what it calls a prominent advisor to the campaign, saying if Biden is elected, he's going to be 82 years old in 4 years, and he won't be running for re-election. Lots of reaction to that, as you might imagine, including on our Facebook page there. Ann Walker writes, "This is very strange. It's hard to believe that this is the first time he or his campaign have thought about Biden's age. Democrats don't want to vote for a one-term president." Hmm. Conrad Beatty says, "Realistically, would he even have the stamina for one term? There comes a point when you have to face the facts of aging and the toll stress takes on a body." Meanwhile, Mark notes that a president's most effective term is the one where his party holds the majorities in Congress. There's nothing lame duck about that. So it does make you wonder, I guess that last comment there implying that if Biden were to come in, if he were to be the presidential nominee and he were to come in on some sort of a wave election, that would nip a lot of that lame duck talk in the bud. Mm-hmm. But yeah, another sort of variable, I guess, for voters to consider here in heading into the 2020 presidential elections. And, you know, Biden, he's depicted his campaign as a sort of rescue mission of sorts, just there to basically eject Trump from the White House. So I guess this is sort of a logical continuation of that in some ways.
Boy, it's very interesting. Yeah. You know, it's I've been reading a lot of analysis, and I know you have as well, Wells, when it comes to the Democratic field as we approach a primary season. Yeah. It's I think a lot of people are rather surprised that Biden has had such staying power so far because he has suffered so many hits along the way, certainly during the Democratic debates.
Yeah, so-called gaffes and whatnot.
Yeah.
Interesting to see. It's almost as if voters are not, there's been a lot of conversation. It seems like some voters are going with who they perceive to be the most electable versus who, in fact, may be the most electable. Yeah. So interesting dynamic interesting playing dynamics. Itself, playing out there. Another interesting topic, folks chiming in about Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg. Times Magazine's Person of the Year, the 16-year-old, the youngest to be named. Again, climate change activist famously sailed around the globe on a yacht or a ship there and spoke at the UN very impassionedly about the need to do more to curtail climate change. Lots of people chiming in via Twitter in Houston, I believe. Marcel McClinton writes that he is so inspired by Greta Thunberg and grateful for the dedicated climate activists around the world who continue to highlight the urgency of this moment. Change is coming. Meanwhile, Frank Fleming writes, "People who believe the same as Greta Thunberg think she's really influential. Everyone else baffled that people would think she is influential." Sort of a Rorschach test there, I guess you could say.
You know, it's something that I'm really interested in right now. I'm looking at that UK election that's coming up on Thursday. That's there could be some surprises there. I think
could be.
A lot of people watching that closely. Let us know what's on your news radar, Texas. Tweet us or join us anytime at TexasStandard.org. Till tomorrow, I'm David Brown along with Wells Dunbar wishing you a wonderful Wednesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare. The Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.